My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Australia is back on track.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
Just dumbstruck.
I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
I don't think I know.
I have no hesitation.
That should cause great concern.
Just sit down,
Let's stick in your eyes.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant.
He needs a mirror.
I mean...
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
G'day and welcome to this episode of Democracy Sausage. I'm Mark Kenny from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute and the School of Politics and International Relations. And this podcast is brought to you each and every week with the fabulous support of the Crawford School of Public Policy's Policy Forum. With me in Canberra is Dr. Maria Teflaga. She's a Speer social scientist, that is School of Politics and International Relations, as mentioned. And she's also the director of the Centre for the Study of Australian Politics. And Maria, it's really terrific to be talking to you as always, but we had a great time last week, did we not? Doing the first ever live Democracy Sausage in front of an audience, the 200th episode. That was a lot of fun.
That was great. Yes. I sincerely hope we do that again.
Yeah, well, I think we do have some plans to do that again and to do some other ways of interacting with our audience, and we'll be doing that in this election campaign. So details of that we'll put out as soon as we finalise them. It's a bit like everything else in an election campaign. We have to keep everyone guessing right until the last minute, much like people on the campaign buses. They never know which city they're going to be in. We're going to do the same thing, although our excuse is that we need to make a number of arrangements to do it, and we're working also with Policy Forum Pod, our sister pod, and we'll be perhaps doing some things with them as well as our own thing. So that's something for people to look out for, and we'll, as I say, get the details out. Now, joining us all the way from Boston, Massachusetts today is Professor Richard Holden. He's Professor of Economics at the University of New South Wales Business School. He's Director of the Economics of Education Knowledge Hub at UNSW Business, and he's Co-Director of the New Economic Policy Initiative. He's also currently the President of the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia. Richard, you're a former faculty member too of the University of Chicago and of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. So I guess what, you're just visiting some old friends and touching base back in the US?
Yeah, Mark, great to be with you. I'm just kind of catching up and reacquainting myself with the center of the economic universe as it was in the US. So it's great to still have a foot in both camps.
Is it? I'm really interested to hear your first impression of talking with both, I guess, professional colleagues, but just other people you know there as well. Whether you get a sort of a different sense of the world from where you are. There's a lot going on, of course, at the moment. We've got the Ukraine-Russia crisis, the invasion of Ukraine. I'm not trying to mince my words there. We've got a lot of talk about China here in Australia, and it's very much part of the election campaign. Of course, the pandemic continues on. Do you get a different sense of the perilous state of the world from the US, or is it much the same?
I don't think it's the same, actually. I get the real sense of, incredible polarization of US politics being here. I get that when I talk to friends on the phone and, on Zoom and all that kind of stuff, which hasn't changed in the last couple of years. But being here in person, there's this real sense that there's enormous polarization in US politics. And as people who are pretty close to, the election in France and things like that, makes really salient how divided our politics is. And most of what people say to me is, isn't it great to be in Australia where things are a little bit more sane? And that really comes home to me.
Yeah, well, they are a little bit more sane, and as you say, we saw France re-elect Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, over the weekend. But there was north of 40% of French voters went with the far right of Marine Le Pen. Was there any interest in that election in the US? I know the US is not particularly Europe focused, generally speaking.
No, I think there is, and I think the damage was the difference between 30-ish% and 40-ish% that you saw in that electoral outcome. So, Macron was re-elected in one sense. There's nothing to see there. The outcome didn't change, but in another sense, a message was sent. And I think that's really worrying. And there's sort of more of a connection than one might imagine between the European cognoscenti and the US, which is there's always been a really strong connection between, US academia and France, and that there are a lot of people who have these sort of strong connections. And so I think there's real concern about that, which is a message was sent, and there's a big difference between a third and closer to a half of the electorate speaking out. And, we'll have to wait and see how that plays out. And Macron so far has sort of stood firm in terms of the way he's going to react to that message. But it's concerning and people are worried.
Maria, that is a concern, isn't it, that the French electorate is so divided? And I guess we'll come back to you on this question as well, Richard, but it poses a challenge. I mean, at one level, Macron could just simply say, well, I've seen off a far-right challenge and I continue on as I was, perhaps even try and be more inclusive, more progressive. On the other hand, he might decide that, there's a strong nationalist and populist sort of tendency in the electorate now, and he needs to find a way of reaching out to those voters in order to keep the whole the republic together, really. So he could go two ways here, and one of them, I guess both of them have some risks.
Yeah, I don't think 40% of the vote going to Marie Le Pen is that's something to be really quite concerned about. She is a candidate from the far right, and it really does sort of speak to some of the divisions in French society around both economic dimensions, around labour market reform, which is something that Macron has tried to pursue and which is a long-running, I guess, discussion in France that is quite different from our politics here. And that was the subject of the sort of yellow jacket protests that went on for weeks and weeks and weeks, but also, some significant cultural threat, cultural threat perception dimensions around, the role of Islam in a secular republic, but one that is ultimately sort of heavily has like a strong Christian identity. And that's kind of where some of this politics in Europe, it's not just France. It's just that in some ways France is at the vanguard of these debates. we see this all over Europe, where European values are increasingly being defined by far-right parties and even just mainstream right parties increasingly as Christian, or European is sort of, broadly kind of equated with a Christian kind of heritage in a way that right-wing politicians here used to really kind of flex into British traditions and which is sort of now kind of more broadly becoming more kind of Western values or Christian values. And
with often an American inflection to them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the departure of Tony Abbott is probably perhaps the last sort of great advocate of British, specifically British,
yes.
Like history and legacy. And this is now a slightly more kind of generalized into a kind of Christian identity. And we see this actually play out with discussions around which refugees will accept, right? So, for example, during the rise of Daesh or ISIS, you had a lot of right-wing politicians in this country happy to accept Christian communities from that part of the world. And, we can kind of see it around the discussion of putting Ukrainians who are Christians at the front of the queue, so to speak, which is the language that the Prime Minister used. And we are seeing populism across the democratic world, and something that political scientists in some ways were kind of blindsided by, which is partially to do with the way our data sets are structured and the fact that, if you've got a time series data set, you often want to preserve the value of that time series, so it's harder to add new questions and so you are in effect trying to measure things like populism, which are quite complicated, using like proxies, which are not always very precise. So, like how you feel about immigration, does that correlate with being a populist? But it is something we're starting to understand a lot more. This is a very long-winded answer to your question. Sorry, Mark.
No, but it raises some very good points. And it had me thinking about, and I'll come to you on this, Richard, about Macron and similarities between Macron and Obama, in the sense of being these kind of new generation leaders that really are almost like the apotheosis of liberal thought, and these ideas around multiculturalism and modernization and different conceptions of identity and the like. And then the backlash that we see that comes against that from people. And we've seen this in the UK, welling up in the form of Brexit and the fall of all of those red wall, Labour seats to the Tories. We've seen it, as Maria said, in a number of European countries. We're seeing it in France now, and we see it in the backlash, after Obama with the election of Donald Trump. I wonder if you're seeing those sorts of tendencies as well, in the US, Richard.
Well, I think places like Europe are a lot closer to these, issues than we are in Australia in a certain way, right? So, when you see kind of refugee crises play out as they did in Germany, where you literally have a million people welling up on your border after what happened in Syria and so on, it's a different scenario than what we've seen in Australia. So I think we're less attuned to it in Australia, and we're a little more immune from it, but there are sort of immutable forces that don't go away, when we see that kind of stuff. So I think we're a little more shielded from it in Australia, but those issues are still definitely there. And I think our politics reflects that, which is we don't have the same kind of, as Marie was saying, Christian conservatism as a force, as a backlash to that. We're not seeing that in quite the same way. That doesn't mean we're not going to see it in the future. It's really a question of how it plays out over time.
Yeah, and I guess that depends to some extent. I mean, all of those situational factors are important, probably fundamental. But one wonders what would happen in Australia in the face or in response to a genuinely charismatic figure arising on the populist right. And that sort of person is not obviously the, distinctly awkward and limited Pauline Hanson, or the clearly self-interested and mercurial and just sort of bizarre Clive Palmer. But down the track, I guess we can't just assume that we are, as an electorate, immune to a sort of a charismatic populist movement that could come along, particularly as we experience difficulties. And a lot of those difficulties, I guess we should be talking to you about now, Richard, because you are an economist after all, and thinking about the forces that are at play underneath all of these populist movements. Often it's economic concerns, feelings of disadvantage and disenfranchisement and of being left behind, as was very much the case with Labour voters in the UK and probably traditional Labour type voters in some of these other polities as well. So I wonder if we might start on that economic sort of dimension by just asking you a general question. You know, how perilous is the world now is the global economy? I mean, you know, is it as dangerous as it feels? Are we facing a situation where inflation could genuinely be out of control and where we could see a range of other sequelae from that?
I think it's a really sort of concerning time. So, you know, in one sense, there's good and bad, which is we're seeing, you know, whether it's in Australia or whether it's in the US or whether it's in the UK, this is true of much of the kind of advanced economies in the world. We're seeing really low unemployment. That's great news. That's really, really good news. But we're seeing for the first time in decades the threat of inflation. And we're seeing people think about that and what it means for their living standards for the first time in a really long time. And people are rightly concerned about that. And so all of these kind of questions about, well, what's happening to our standard of living are really front of mind. And there'll be continued questions about, you know, what's the right sort of system? What's the right economic and democratic system to address those concerns? And that's been an uncontested question for a really long time. You know, for a really long time, the answer has been, well, you know, it's some version of liberalism and it's sort of what we've got. And, you know, that's the way it's going to go. And people are starting to, you know, ask the question, well, is that what it should be, or should it be something else? And so I think that's the real, that's the real concern for the political system, which is, are we well equipped to address those questions? And one of the things that you touched on earlier, and it goes to the Le Pen question, is all of a sudden the far right have become a lot more professional. And I think one of the big lessons from, you know, this French election is Le Pen didn't just win another, you know, 5 or 10% of the vote. That's true. That's a fact. But Le Pen got a lot slicker, and Le Pen got advised a lot better, and took it more seriously, basically. And so we can sort of satisfy ourselves with the situation in Australia and say, well, that would never happen here. But, you know, one of the questions is what would happen if Clive Palmer or Pauline Hanson kind of got their act together in another kind of way? What if they were advised better, and what if they were slicker? And what if they could animate those legitimate concerns concerns in many ways, but legitimate concerns on the right? And what if they could vocalize those better? And that's kind of what terrifies me in a certain kind of way.
Well, I think it terrifies many people as a question. I think the only consoling thing there is that, as I said before, I just can't see it happening with either of these two particularly flawed characters. I just don't think the depth is there. There's just not enough to work with.
We're also sort of insulated in a way with compulsory voting, right? And that we can kind of see that cutting two ways right now. You know, there's a whole group of people who might have just refuse to vote, that are voting for Pauline Hanson or Clive Palmer because they're looking for a protest vote. And, you know, and Richard's kind of, he's right. When we sort of talk about the political system in terms of its ability to kind of deliver, problems and solutions for the future. And that's actually a conversation we have been having for at least a decade. And the final thing I will sort of make the point is that we actually kind of saw a similar pattern arise in the 1970s, which was, you know, sparked by an inflation crisis, where, you know, we reached the end of a policy orthodoxy, and it actually took political systems a good 10 years to kind of come up with the alternative, which was the neoliberal system that we all lived through. And we're kind of at the crunch reckoning point now. You know, policy has been left to drift for an awful long time. The urgency and the need for change is becoming more and more apparent. People are aware of it. So, you know, it doesn't mean that things will necessarily get better, but that opportunity space, that punctuated equilibrium, to use political science jargon, is now arising. It is a chance to actually do something new.
I think that comes from evolutionary biology, actually. But
yeah. Oh, we love to steal stuff from science, right? Political science. Correct. So, yeah.
Look, let's take a very quick break and continue this discussion in a moment.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
All right, welcome back. Well, just before the break, we were talking about punctuated equilibrium and various other things, about whether we are at a crunch point in terms of that, or coming up against the limits of that the sort of neoliberal policy agenda. One sign of that, I suppose, Richard Holden, is Clive Palmer's very populist appeal to a fixed maximum 3% interest rate. I wonder, as an economist, whether you could just deconstruct that for us.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, that's the top line is that's a bad idea.
big surprise. You know,
big surprise. No shocks there. Look, it's both populist and a bad idea, right? Which is, it's responding to a legitimate concern, which is the most important thing in a lot of people's lives is, you know, what the interest rate they're going to pay on their mortgage or how it affects their lives in various different ways. And so it's very understandable. And as a populist appeal, it's a, you know, it's an understandable thing to grab onto. You know, I can't believe we're going to have to go back into this kind of, you know, discussion, but these ideas of, you know, price fixing and command and control economies really go back to, you know, the 1970s and the debates about, you know, whether we want to live in the Soviet Union or the United States or something like that. So it's almost comical to go back there in a way. But, you know, we've lived for a very long time in most of the world in a situation where we understand that markets work pretty well. They need to be mediated, as they have been for a really long time in Australia. you know, they need to be mediated by, minimum wages, and they need to be mediated by internalizing externalities and dealing with, you know, the worst excesses of certain things. But the bottom line is, you know, you put the government in control of setting prices, that's a recipe for disaster. And so even though it's, you know, got certain populist appeal, and that's what the Palmer policy is playing to in a very stark way, it's a bad idea, and it would, you know, it would also never happen. So it's kind of a cheap thing for him
to
say.
Isn't that, that's sort of, sorry to jump in there, but that's the kind of problem with it, isn't it? That I ask you why it's a bad idea, and I'm getting, I'm not having any trouble understanding you, but it's nowhere near as simple as a response as the assertion to begin with, which is I'm going to set interest rates at a maximum of 3%. I mean, a lot of people who haven't studied economics might just say, well, that sounds like a pretty good policy to me, and just go with it. The response needs to be, you know, the response in a sense is an argument about orthodoxy and the complexity of markets and not having governments directing prices and so forth. And all of those things are valid, but they're not on a bumper sticker, if you know what I mean.
No, that's exactly right. And I think one of the things that's important in all of this is there have been ideas that have been uncontested for, you know, more than a generation. And I'm 47 years old, right? So when I say a generation, I kind of mean an earlier time that was pre-Berlin Wall falling and things like that.
Right.
There are discussions that we haven't had about these like core philosophical ideas that we really haven't had. And it's more true in Australia than in places like the United States, because in Australia, as has been discussed, we haven't had a real recession, you know, until the coronavirus crisis. We haven't had a real recession in over 30 years. So there's a whole lot of people who just haven't seen kind of normal economic swings and roundabouts.
Thanks in large measure to China.
Yeah, that's been kind of helpful, right? Like that the, you know, an economy, it's important to remember that I had to look this up the other day when I was writing a column as to when Bill Clinton was president, what was the size of China's economy? And it was about the size of Maine, you know, like an inconsequential state of the United States. And I have a lot of friends from Maine, so I don't, you know, say that with any,
malice,
with any ill will. But it was tiny. And it's now the same size as the United States. And that was 30 years ago. And that's an extraordinary thing. And Australia has benefited from that, you know, more than we can calculate, basically. And it's changed our economy extraordinarily. And it's changed our politics a lot. And I think one of the things that's really important about this is that we've gone from being a place in Australia where we sort of think about our economy as being very diversified to one where our three biggest export industries, and again, the coronavirus crisis has kind of changed this, but between iron ore and coal and education, they're essentially our three largest export industries, and they all go to China. And China's increasingly under the control of a person who can just turn that tap off if literally he wants to. And that just isn't the way we used to think about things in this country. And so, you know, if that happens and our three largest export industries kind of disappear or come under enormous threat, that's something we're going to have to think about in a really big way, and it's going to change our politics as well as our economics.
Yeah, Maria, it always seems to me like sort of there's a sort of a hypocrisy in our political discourse in this country, and obviously there's a clear hypocrisy in the discourse in China as well. you know, with what it purports to be as an economy and its respect for its people, and then the way you know, human rights are abused and people are controlled, and you know, edicts are issued and people must obey them and so forth. You know, very much a powerful autocratic surveillance state. But we have our own hypocrisy in the sense that, you know, during that period that Richard's just described of this extraordinary growth of China and the hunger it has for our exports, that we've benefited enormously from this in an economic sense, but our political discourse has been travelling almost in the other direction, and is sort of operates like as if it's in an entirely different world, where we talk about China in very negative terms, and increasingly that's the case. And on both sides of politics, you know, there's not a whole lot of difference, and yet here we are avoiding all of these economic shocks over time. And our economy growing and growing when other economies aren't, through those shocks because of our dependence and fantastic economic relationship with China, which is, you know, just flooding our government with and our companies with income, with revenue.
Well, I guess the context for that was a China that, I guess, at the end of the Cold War and the sort of liberalization and experiments, particularly before Tiananmen, of the sort of Deng regime, that there was this sort of pretty breezy argument being made that economic growth would lead to a development of a middle class, and a middle class would demand political rights. And we've sort of seen a very mixed pattern of that relationship across the world, really, and it is actually a major debate of our discipline, which we don't really understand because, you know, there's evidence pointing one way and evidence pointing the other. I think that the way we talk about, I think Australians do understand that we are financially dependent on China, in a way that we used to be sort of dependent on our relationship with Britain, right? And I have a feeling this is what drives some of the disquiet or frustration, even in the general community, which is sort of showing up in polling data, but also in the sort of audible groan that happened during the debate last week, when Scott Morrison sort of lent into or re sort of excavated his Manchurian candidate kind of style attacks on Labor. And I think there is an understanding amongst enough of the population that this is a complex relationship that we have with China, that much of our wealth is and our prosperity and our ability to avoid or the resilience of our economy is there, and that it's a relationship that actually really needs to be managed. And I do find it really interesting that the government is sort of doubling down on its aggressive language around China, and you do sort of see different kinds of messaging coming out of different parts of the government. You know, it's a really sort of hard sort of security tack with Peter Dutton, and Morrison kind of like leans in and out of this debate. But that is, you know, that is a reality of how we make money in this country. It also explains why we've made little progress on climate change, because of the perceptions of where our national wealth is. And it is a conversation that we're going to actually have to have over the coming decade about whether or not this leaves us vulnerable and whether or not we want to do anything about it. And to be fair to the coalition, this is actually a huge part of the Turnbull agenda, you know? I mean, that was actually like most of his sort of shtick, which at the time people weren't terribly interested in, I have to confess.
Yes, you say complex relationship. I'd say, yes, that's true. It's complex. Another word might be duplicitous, in the sense that, you know, we, like I say, we just have this kind of, we want to keep doing business, but we also want to talk about China as if it is this. Well, we're now actually into talking about China as if it's an enemy. I mean, we had Peter Dutton in the last 24 hours on Anzac Day, no less, saying that Australia must prepare for war.
Yeah, this is needlessly inflammatory. I mean, you know, I don't see the sort of logic in it. You know, the government doesn't really want to talk about human rights and China's human rights record because of our own patchy record on that field in relation to asylum seekers and refugees. But to be fair, right, we live in a dangerous world. We've always lived in a dangerous world.
But isn't this really just the government saying, look, you know, you keep standing too close to us on China. There's too much bipartisanship here. And so they're just sort of straying further and further toward the kind of slightly mad end of this debate. Because at some point they're hoping that Labor will break away, at which point they can say, see, we told you they're not tough on China. We told you they don't have the sand to stand up to Beijing. We told you that they are Manchurian candidates or whatever else. And, you know, presumably that's what's going on here. The coalition's frustrated at the oneness from the opposition on this question.
Yeah, and I, you know what? That's actually a really good point. Mark, and I think the foreign policy establishment would broadly speaking agree with you. And I'll extend that point by saying the problem for the coalition with China, right, is that this debate used to happen, the security debate used to happen around the arc of the United States, right? You know, our great powerful ally who was a global superpower, and so like any great power, often do things that are not exactly nice, right? Or you know, they'll violate international agreements or act in unilateral ways, and that isn't necessarily au fait with the rules-based order. And there's a whole cohort of people on the left whose entire bread and butter came out of criticizing the United States for that. You know, either because of the sort of Cold War context where you've got these rival sort of systems, or simply that you've got this unipolar world, but the thing is that the United States was a democracy, and so and people had lived through the Cold War, where the bad guys, so to speak, were the sort of Soviet Union. But now, you know, pitching this around China, right? Trying to get Labor to break on China. I think this is a fool's errand. It's not going to happen. I mean, you know, like the sort of underlying assumption here is that, you know, Labor doesn't believe in Australia and doesn't believe in Australia's national interest, right? But I just think this is mad. Like this is not going to work. It's not the same frame. You know, and the war in Ukraine, I think, really sort of shows this. You know, the coalition was probably sort of expecting some level of criticism around this, but if anything, the left has kind of moved in and parked itself behind the Ukrainian conflict and you know have suddenly become warmongers in effect, right? Mm. Like the whole tectonics of politics, like, you know, these plates have unmoored at the GFC and they have slowly been moving. And the coalition reality is starting to catch up with them. And that's because they didn't do a lot of renewal work whilst they were in opposition. And as a government, because they have a new prime minister every 3 years, they have effectively set the reset button each time and they haven't really been able to pivot. I think if Malcolm Turnbull had remained prime minister, this would be less of a problem for them, but he didn't.
No, he didn't. Instead, they had a prime minister who didn't really promise to do much other than deliver some tax cuts and not be Bill Shorten, and that turned out to be enough. But
that's right.
And if it hadn't been for the pandemic, you know, there wouldn't have been all that much to do. I mean, Parliament hardly ever sits anyway. Look, we've got this, you know, one of the world's great economists here, so I think we should at least come back to the economic question in the few minutes that we've got left. Richard, I wonder, can I draw you to interest rates again and that general frame and ask you about, one, whether you think interest rates will go up here, and is it possible that it will happen during the election campaign, as was the case in 2007, which was none too convenient for the Howard government, outgoing as it became, not necessarily just as a result of that, but it certainly didn't help. Is that a possibility, or will there be a rate rise sort of fairly shortly after the election so that if there's a new government, it will be handling that? And I think as an allied question, if I can double barrel this, Are we just missing something here in the whole question about housing affordability and access to the housing market? You know, there were some policies in the last election that Labor took to the electorate but was defeated. Labor's now walked away from that, you know, curbing capital gains tax concessions, limiting negative gearing. These were things associated with trying to take some of the heat out of the housing market and make it more affordable. So those two questions about an interest rate rise and housing policy generally.
Yeah, well, I think yes and yes is the short answer to your question. So let me unpack that a little bit.
A short answer to my long question.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I think in terms of interest rates, there's this broad sort of tectonic view of things, which is there was a world where there was a world of the 1980s and 1990s and the early 2000s where interest rates were, broadly speaking, reasonably high. And there's a bunch of global forces, the balance between the supply and demand of money that have brought those interest rates down to some degree. And we've seen that play out in a fairly messy kind of way. But the bottom line is you should think of the RBA cash rate in Australia in normal times as being more like 3% than more like 6 or 7%. And so you should think of, like, you know, those kind of scary mortgage interest rates of 17% as being anomalies of a different era and things like that. And so where are we now relative to that? We're on the low side of that relative to that. So we're going to see interest rates go up from here. But we're not going to see them go up to those kind of scary levels. Now, going up 3-4 percentage points from where they are now for a lot of heavily indebted households is going to be a troubling and scary thing. And so that's not going to be easy for a whole lot of folks. But we shouldn't think about this as a return to the kind of late 1980s or something like that. So I think that's the sort of general view of interest rates, and that'll mean that there's, you know, this shift in the relative merits of borrowing and investing, and that's something that we've seen play out for a long period of time now. When it comes to housing affordability, I think this is just it's not a peculiarly Australian problem, but it's an importantly Australian problem. And both sides of politics have done nothing about this. They've just done nothing about this. So, you know, I had a policy about, you know, it's, I wrote a paper in, I don't know, 2015 for the Mikkel Institute that became Labor Party policy at two elections. Both of which they lost.
So they tried to do something about it.
Yeah, they did, to their credit, to their great credit, I must say, and bravely so, although at the last one they coupled it with some other ideas that, you know, I'm not a politician, so who am I to say? But
went from brave to crazy brave, you say.
May have worked well or may have worked poorly. I don't really know how to pass that. But But the basic idea is that we provide massive incentives for people to buy investment properties in Australia in a way that I think creates a very unlevel playing field between people who want to own homes and want to invest in buying homes as investment properties. And I think that's a, you know, a bad idea, and it's an idea that creates a very unlevel playing field and makes it very hard for young people. You know, there are a lot of other things going on in the Australian property market, which is, you know, you take a place like Sydney, it's supply constrained on a whole lot of different dimensions, and you just look at the geography of it and it's complicated, right? So there are many, many other things going on. But we're not helping matters by turbocharging the ability for people to buy investment properties. And that's no news. Everyone's understood this for a really long time. And government after government, back in fact to the 1950s, actually, with the first, you know, first homeowner type incentives on both sides of politics, have just thrown petrol on the fire when it's come to this stuff. And it's inherently tempting, which is people say, oh, we want young people to be able to get into the property market. Let's give them something to do it. And when you give them something to do it, that gives everyone something to do it, and that drives up prices. And it's just it's sort of, you know, people can't help, politicians can't help themselves, and so they do it.
And the logic is that if they were to do anything about it, that this would result in the loss of some wealth for a significant proportion of the electorate that owns their own home. That is, that we could see prices come down, and that would, the house price is a key asset of many Australian households, of course, and for those with investment properties, it would be, you know, also devalue their property. So no political party seems to have the will to actually confront the problem that to make houses more affordable means making them cheaper.
This is exactly the problem you get yourself into, which is you create the problem and it's bad enough, and then you want to remedy it, and people are going to lose. So you know, what is the answer if you actually do something about this, which is, as you exactly said, Mark, prices go down. And, you know, if you're an owner of property, that's a bad, that, you know, that's a bad story, right? So, and now it's almost impossible to do something about it because it's going to lead to this. There was a time when it was, we can make prices go up not as fast as they were going to go up by. We can kind of squeak our way out of it. And now it's almost like prices have to go down for us to deal with it.
Exactly.
And that's an unacceptable answer to most of the electorate. And once we're in that position, we're kind of done. And I don't know how we're going to get out of that position. And it suddenly becomes a politically charged question that nobody wants to go near.
Well, only two ways, Richard. One is a crisis where we see lots of people lose their homes, or the other is through the kind of sustained advocacy that sort of saw things like the introduction of Medicare, which was a trade-off between wages. You know, wages were frozen and went down. You know, especially if you were a low-skilled worker, for much of the 80s, really, and in exchange you got a social sort of safety net. And I think what's really interesting is that some of the focus group research around housing shows that people actually do understand that their children are losing out, and so it really sort of depends on how these debates are effectively framed. But as we have discussed many times on this podcast, it is probably not something that a opposition can kind of take on.
Correct. And that was really, in a sense, we'll have to end there, but that was really the sense of the real tragedy of that defeat at the last election. Wasn't the defeat of Labor Party or the collapse of the credibility of opinion polls. It was the defeat of bold policy and the demonstration that there are limits to what you can propose from opposition in terms of the breadth and complexity of policy. And some of those policies, things like, not related to housing, but the franking credits changes, which was very sound policy, but which taken together with the ones I mentioned, negative gearing, capital gains tax and other things, became this big negative. And those policies are largely lost now, to go back to a term you used before, Richard, probably lost for a generation because no politician can propose to do it from opposition, and mostly are forced to forswear it before getting elected, that they won't touch negative gearing, that they won't reintroduce, they won't remove franking credits and these sorts of things. So Big costs associated with that in terms of policy. We're going to have to wrap up there because we just simply run out of time, but there's so much more we could talk about, particularly in terms of budget repair. There's no budget repair going on at the moment. We were told there was going to be once unemployment was, safely below 5%. It's now actually below 4%, and we're still not seeing it. There's an election going on, so I guess that explains that. But, what will happen after the election? There's so many other unknowns about the economy we could talk about. We've run out of time, unfortunately. But thanks very much, Richard Holden, for your time today. Really appreciate having you on the podcast. Look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks so much, Mark.
And thanks, Maria, as always.
Thank you.
That's Democracy Sausage for this week. As I say, we'll have some interesting things coming up, hopefully, in the what remains of the election campaign, which is, the best part of a month. There's still plenty of time. So keep your eye out for that. We'll use our social media channels to let you know about that. And if you're in the Canberra region, that could mean some more live events, and we hope to see you then. So until next week, bye for now.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.